A podcast, oh boy.
Hello, my name is Fran Corcoran. I'm on the board here at Theater in the Round. Welcome this afternoon to the name of our production is Color and Theater, something very much like that. A couple of things. I've been volunteering here since the Nixon administration, and I've seen a lot of shows, and of course every single one of them is lit somehow by some magic or another. And these gentlemen are among the many people who have volunteered here to do that very sort of thing for us. Briefly, I would like to introduce Mark Kiefer, who's done about a dozen shows with us as a volunteer, and he is lighting Rhinoceros, which is coming up after And Then There Were None closes, so the January show.
Yep.
And this is Rick Polonek, who has designed, I don't know how many shows here, 100?
Not 100, but
50,
a few.
50, and has been in the trade for, we figured about 50 years. Yeah, so he does know his warms from his cools. Unlike myself, who do not, you know, I'm not an artist of any kind myself, and I surely don't go up on ladders, but I'm just taking up watercolor, and I cannot get it about what's a warm color and what's a cool color, so that's why I signed up for this. So I thought maybe, you know, in the course of some amount of time, I would grasp something more about it so that I kind of get the idea of it. First, I would like to ask you all to briefly introduce yourselves and tell how it is that or why you thought you'd want to come to a little talk about color. I'll start with you up there in the tippy top. Ooh, good answer.
Good answer.
Yes. And then you?
Hi, my name is Abby Crone, and I'm a property and set designer, and I thought it would be really good to learn about lighting and how it affects the different colors in my sets.
Again, good answer. And then you?
My name is Brenna. I'm here because I'm interested in lighting and direct art.
Good.
I'm Brooke, and I'm a theater person who hasn't done a lot of theater in a few years, and we just recently moved back to the Twin Cities, so wanted to start meeting more theater people and volunteering in different, you know, theater communities.
We encourage that here. Yes.
Yeah. My name is Seiji, and I just love, you know, anything that has to do with creativity. I'm a visual artist, you know, but I want to kind of like move more into the, you know, what I see as like social arts, which I think theater fits into. Mm-hmm.
Great.
I'm Colleen. I've been doing technical theater for 11 years. And
you don't look old enough, just saying.
I'm designing a set next summer, and I want to know how lighting will affect that.
Good, very good.
You're saying she should look more haggard? Is
that... Well, you should look like you're not 14 anyway.
My name is Roberta, and I've done a lot of directing at, in the college arena.
Great. And you are?
Yeah, I'm Angie. I do shadow puppetry sometimes and want to see how to play with that. And I also have a studio that has performances, and the other person always does the lights, so I kind of want to know what to do with them.
Yeah, great. Well then, we are all well matched. I'm sorry to say that Sadie Ward, who was the headliner for today, has been ill for a bunch of days, and so the hands-on part about going up and turning the lights on and off by her is sort of on hold because we have a show up now, as you can see, and we don't really get to mess around with other people's light plots during their shows, so they don't like it.
Basic things ultimately. I mean, because I didn't get a chance to really go through the plot here, but there's definitely a warm and a cool cross system, which is, kind of where you start. So,
can you tell, right this minute, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
There's warm and cool in here?
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell where those are? I don't...
Well,
turn the work lights off. It'd be a lot easier to see.
One moment.
Of course not.
thing is kind of a pain. It doesn't always do what you expect it to.
There. So what we have here is a system of, because in the arena you have to light everything from all angles, because, you know,
the backlight for these people is your front light. And so what this is a warm cross. It's some sort of an amber. I can't exactly see what. Oh, this is actually the most common color used on the stage. We call it bastard amber, which is the name that it came up. But it's kind of a funny story. I sometimes go into anecdotes rather quickly, but it's happened at the Metropolitan Opera in like the 19-teens or something. The lighting designer went to the place where they make theatrical gel, and they had been making some amber gels, and they screwed something up. And the guy said, well, here, take some of this and see what you want to do with it, because it was a mistake, but, you know, see if you like it. And he took it back, and he used it for something, and he loved it, and he came back to the shop a few weeks later and said, can you make more of that bastard amber? Because it was, you know, it was the wrong amber. and the name stuck. So, but this is just a really flattering, warm color that looks good on skin. That will go out. And then if I bring up So, guess what? This is a cool system. And it's crossing from the opposite direction. And when you combine the two, you have a cross system where you have warm light and cool light. And so as you turn through this space, it changes, but you have shadows of warm and cool. And so, I mean, combined, this actually makes pretty much a white light, but you hardly ever see the act, but there are subtle shadows in that as you play the space. And then you can manipulate that with the levels and the intensity if you want more cool light than warm light. You know, if you want to have, say, like it's an evening scene or it's a nighttime scene, if you do... No, that's not what I want to do. I've got to use this. That's not what I want to do. So, if I bring that system up, this is a really kind of a nice shadowy look, which still has some good visibility to it. But then if I do something like this, oh, is at this 6. There. So now I can bring that up at a lower level, and it changes things, and you can manipulate that way. So, I mean, that is just a really, really basic introduction to, if you ever hear someone refer to a lighting system as McCandless, this cross system is basically that, and that was a system designed, sort of cooked up by Stanley McCandless, who was, I believe, at, I'm trying to forget what university he was at, in the 30s, this idea of crossing a warm and a cool color and then manipulating that back and forth. Because that was part of the evolution of stage lighting when it went from, well, gas light to early electric lights, which tended to just be troughs of light bulbs. And then by the 1930s, both lighting control and actually using individual spotlights started to take over, at least in the academic institutions. And he was one of the first theorists who worked with that. He's at Yale. He was at the Yale Drama School.
Rick, could you have your array of colors here, and
colors.
Could you tell where the edges are between warm and cool, and what's warm and what's cool? Because I can't remember. I can't figure it.
I'm going to turn the lights back on so you can see.
Well, warm colors, I think, are basically what we think of as earth colors. We think of dirt and minerals and the oranges and the yellows and the browns, kind of dirty colors. I mean, that's a big generalization because there's some fine lines between warm and cool. And the cool colors, think of water, think of sky, think of those sorts of the blues and the blue greens. We think of those as cool colors. If you look at just that spread of colors there going from warm all the way around to cool, it's really challenging. And one of the things that Sadie was going to talk about was a little bit of color bias theory, which I don't know a lot about it. I haven't studied a lot about it, but if you Google color bias theory, there are all kinds of things out there. But basically what that says is that individual colors have a bias. And one example that I read earlier when I was kind of researching this is a red, for example, can have a bias towards orange or a bias towards purple, and it has to do with how the color is mixed. It's so hard to find pure pigment. Everything that you buy off of this chart has been mixed, and there's so many impurities in there. One of the challenges frustrations that I have, and I taught for a number of years in the college systems, was having students try to mix a purple. Well, you take a red and you take a blue, and 9 times out of 10, you get mud, simply because
you get
purplish gray. Yeah, exactly. You can't find. It's very hard to find a pure red or a pure blue. Or you may be using a red which has a bias towards orange, so you try to mix that with blue,
yeah,
and you're going to get mud. So that whole idea of color bias is that. Each of these colors, or the primary colors in particular, lean one way or the other. So if you take something like what's called a cadmium red, which is much kind of an oranger red, mix that with yellow, you're going to get a nice orange. But try to mix that with blue, and you're going to get mud. So the challenge is, what happens with scene paints, and I've kind of pulled this end of the color wheel. You look at all of these colors there, you're not going to find very much pure color there. Scenic paints tend to be as close to pure pigment as you can get. And there are maybe, 25 or 30 colors in the range of scenic paints that we use. And they're designed primarily to be mixed. Very rarely do you use scenic paint straight out of the can. You're buying those sort of pure colors in order to be able to mix paints and to mix your own colors. So the scenic paints are as close as we get. They're a little more expensive, but scenic paints really allow you a lot more latitude in terms of mixing color. So I kind of went far afield of your warm and cool. But
well, since we're on a set,
yeah.
What color is this? Is this warm? Is this floor warm or cool or what?
Well,
I mean, I can't.
There's a lot of both in
there. It's a mixture of both because, yeah. you have the wood. And that's one of the things about successful scenic painting is incorporating those layers so that it does this dance, if possible.
Mm-hmm.
Because, it looks to me like the base here is a fairly warm beige or tan.
So these guys painted here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was the base.
And but then there's the wood grain, which was rolled on, it looks like, which is a very sort of cool black.
Mm-hmm. So you've got a lot of layers.
But then sponged on top of that are a couple of different browns that range from neutral to what quite warm.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's what I'm seeing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you all see that? Cool, huh?
No, warm.
A worm.
Well,
it's some of each. You know.
And that's one of the things that about unique about this theater is because we don't have much for set or backdrops, mm-hmm. is the floor sort of ends up being our painted drop,
right.
oftentimes.
Yeah.
I mean, you might come in here and see a show where the floor is just black or even where it's gray carpet, but that's not normal. Mm-hmm. That's the exception.
So what's your concern with lighting the floor then? What would be some of your concerns?
I would not have much concern at all about lighting this floor because it's going to react pretty well to almost anything you throw at it. Because if I put blue light on it, it's going to gray out a little bit, and you're not going to see the browns as much, but you'll see more wood grain. If I put warm light on it, you're going to notice the brown undertones and overcoats more so. You're still going to see the black because it's just there.
Mm-hmm. And that, I think, as a scenic designer, a concern or a consideration that I always have, because the lighting designer is my best friend. The
make
lighting designer
pretty.
Can destroy a beautiful design or make an ugly design really pretty. So I am very dependent on the lighting designer's opinion and what the lighting designer brings to that mixture.
Anecdotally here, I was telling these guys a story. I did the lighting for Anne of Green Gables here about 2 years ago, and the set designer and I were having a bit of a tiff about the color green that the floor was going to be, and she wanted it to be this, I mean, it was green, it was really green, and I thought it was obnoxious, and I originally was going to use amber as my warm, which makes green... It complements green, and it makes green look green. Whereas another color, another warm color that you could certainly use, which I would consider... Well, amber is what I call a warm, but pinks, especially... Because pink has a lot more blue in it than amber does. Well, I should say what pink does is it filters out the green light that would be in amber light. I switched to using a coolish pink for my warm, which still looks fine on skin. And it just knocked the chroma value of that green down about 3 notches. It kind of grayed it out a little bit. She was not happy. I thought it looked great. So,
creative differences.
But that's the kind of thing you can do with lighting. Now, I mean, and I could have made an even more disastrous decision and used like a gaslight green as a warm color, which would have, you know, taken it from bright green to fluorescent green. So that's, I mean, that's kind of the thing. So, you know, you're always having to pay attention to costumes. The other thing that, you know, is always an issue is you have to look at the individual skin tone of the actors sometimes. Asian and African-American actors do not look particularly good under pink light. They look much better under amber light. Whereas the lighter-skinned people, it doesn't matter as much. So yeah, that's something you always have to take into account. Like when, did Marriage of Bette and Boo, that was not taken into account, and it was not good. What it did to some of the Asian actors in the show.
And I think that's where the whole idea of collaboration is really important, because each of us as designers kind of work in our own world, and I'm in my studio and whipping up gorgeous colors for a rendering, and a costumer is going through the racks and looking for his or her colors, and the lighting designer is trying to figure out a palette. But that all has to come together, and certainly the lighting designer has to consider skin tone and costume color and the color of the floor and the color of the upholstery here. So I can't, as a designer, selfishly cling to that one thing that makes me happy, because actors in costume are going to have to sit on that upholstery, and the lighting designer is going to have to make them all look beautiful, their skin and their costume and the couch that they're sitting on. So that idea of just that communication, especially about color and being really out there with color choices very early on, because the lighting designer, especially, I have a great deal of sympathy, come in relatively late
right.
to the process after the costumes have been selected and mm-hmm. the color palette has been selected for the set. Here, make it look beautiful.
Or ugly.
Or
and honestly, I have put up a whole system, and then 3 days into tech, I'm like, I have to change that system color. It's just not working. Which, you know, it's changing out gel and 25 lights is not a simple task, but it's not Herculean, it's not horrible. And sometimes you just have to do it. The other thing is there's certain colors that I always plead designers to avoid in any significant amount of quantities, and that is bright greens and turquoise. Because those are notoriously hard to light without them, the value shifting way weirdly, in my opinion.
So of all the colors there are, those two are the worst?
I find them the worst. Now, you may talk to 10 other lighting designers and they have no issue with them. But anytime someone says, oh, we're going to put him in a turquoise jacket, I'm like, no, please, no.
Spare us.
What would you do, though, if you had to light that? Would it be a cool light or a warm light?
Well, certainly, whenever there's turquoise or those greens, you have to stay away from what I call the cooler warms, the pinks, and the lavenders more so, because those gray those colors out. Whereas amber and blue make them pop.
So that's why those two chairs look really lovely in the amber, bastard amber, and blue light that you have.
Correct. If I put a bright pink light on that, it would look quite different.
Quite unattractive.
probably, unless that's what you're going for. You know, sometimes that...
You want icky of colored furniture.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, you know, honestly, something like an upholstered chair is a lot less problematic than a costume.
Because they stay put.
Right, because they stay put. And, you know, the actors move.
Mm-hmm. Can't prevent them.
And the floor is just a lot bigger. But, you know, and I'm sort of speaking about, maybe I should give you a little more about actual just lighting color theory. Because when you go through the color spectrum, well, lighting is always additive color, by the way. So the three primaries for lighting are red, blue, and green. Because, I mean, that goes back to, you know, your old-fashioned, well, actually all television sets, all those pictures are made by those three colors in various quantities. And
so why green and not yellow?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the color,
the
primary,
because
physics.
Because of physics?
Yeah.
Red, green, and blue, white light. Red? Red, green, and blue combined make white light.
Exactly.
Huh.
And, but then you can play with that. Because then you have the secondary colors, because when you have green and red, you get yellow. And when you have blue and red, you get magenta, or, you know, deep pink. And then when you combine, what have I missed, green and blue, you get cyan, or turquoise. And so, across from each other, if you combine yellow light with turquoise or bluish light, you also get white light. And so that's all a subtle playing there. But, you know, let me think through. I had a color wheel up before.
It's always a great experiment that I love to do with an introductory lighting class.
Absolutely.
Hang those three primary lighting color fixtures aimed into kind of a circle on the floor, and
right.
in the center of that, my God, it's white
it's
light.
It's white light.
It's amazing. I mean, it really is like the magic of lighting when you can kind of see that combination. Yeah, physics.
And, you know, then there are other things. But because light's almost always coming from various angles, you know, some interesting tricks that I have learned, because basically, you don't ever come up with this stuff on your own. You just steal shamelessly from the good ones.
That's why you're here. Steal shamelessly.
Because, like, when I was doing Suddenly Last Summer here, which was the last show in the arena, that whole play takes place in a backyard. It's New Orleans. It's hot. It's oppressive. Well, it's maybe not oppressive because it's November. But what I have found is that if you take colors from around the color wheel, especially with the projections, the texture projections we call gobos. I don't know why they're called gobos. It's just what we call them. But I did a foliage projection of the whole arena. It was 16 lights, four from each of the four angles, and I used colors from around the color wheel for that, which creates this marvelous sense of dimensionality and texture. When you have these foliage patterns coming, you know, one was a light blue, and then across from that you use an amber. But then from the other sides, I used a sort of a lilac violet and then a pale green, because they're across from each other more or less on the color wheel. And put a little haze in that, and it just, that's the magic.
Wow. So you would never put two colors in one instrument as two gels in one instrument?
Well, that's just foolish.
Okay, well, okay.
No, because, good to know. because it's like, I mean, you can do that if you know exactly what you're doing and the effect you're trying to go for.
But mostly no.
There's probably another color in the gel book that creates that color and is going to give you better transmission. Because light, whenever you put a gel in front of a light, you knock down how much light comes out of it because you're filtering out the colors you don't want. And so as soon as you put, say, a pink and an amber gel in a light, you're probably going to cut the transmission down more so than by using the actual gel that would approximate that color. And it's becoming less of an issue with the new LED technologies, but lighting designers always want it brighter, or want the ability to have it brighter. It's never as bright as you want most of the time. And especially with the old incandescent technology, the blues, you can never get enough blue because there's so little blue in incandescent light. Once you filter out all the reds and the greens and you're just down to the blue, it just, you know, like a primary blue gel only lets about 10% of the light is making through. Whereas like this amber is letting about 80% of the light that fixture is making through.
Wow. So to compensate, do you sometimes have to hang a couple of blue to like cast more light to mix with whatever the...
That's one approach. I know certain stages that where I've worked, it's always like, okay, if you're going to use blue top light on this stage, you just hang two Fresnels and two Frem right off the bat because you're going to need it for the punch. But sometimes you can also use a different fixture that's punchier because the Fresnel is actually, they're horribly inefficient. Because they're basically
that's a type of lighting instrument
because they're basically a plano convex spotlight. You know, it's the oldest spotlight technology and it's the least efficient. So there are newer technologies that use better reflectors that, like the Fresnel, that's a Fresnel where you can see that the blues. At their best, they pass about 30% of the light from the bulb through, whereas like these ellipsoidal reflector spotlights are closer to 50% efficient at getting the light through. And like PAR cans are even better at that, but they're sloppy, but they're closer to 60%. So, it's always trade-offs, and it's combining all these tools to get the result. So I don't know, it's a meandering way to answer that question, but...
Yeah, as I'm looking up here, it looks to me, in some ways, like there's a whole lot of instruments up there to make anything for this show. Now, you probably know this, every time we strike a set from here, all the lights come down, every single one. And that same day, all the lights go up for the next show, because you have to do that before you, you know, I mean, you have to do that before you
mess
around.
That's the approach we choose here.
Yeah.
And most professional theaters do that. Well, it depends on the house. Like at Children's and at Guthrie, there's a rep plot at the Guthrie for the, both the proscenium and the thrust. Children's has more or less a rep plot, a repertory plot, that then, you know, designers use and manipulate in various ways. Certainly, most of those lights get refocused every time, but they don't always get struck.
Yeah.
The reason we strike here is because there's just so many approaches to it, and different shows, and the electrical system in here is irritating.
But better than it used to be.
Yes, it keeps getting better. There is that. But yeah, you know, there's, because we typically hang between 80 and 120 lights for a show here. And we have, and part of the reason for that is because the ceiling is relatively low and you have to light from all sides. Because when you go from lighting on a proscenium stage to in the round, your instrument count goes up by like 30% right there. Because, you know, if I'm lighting on a proscenium, I don't really have to worry about it. I only need half as much backlight.
So, costumes.
Mm-hmm.
And color. I mean, you can probably flatten out any frock you'd like to with some indiscreet color. And then, mm-hmm. What do you know about the clothes before they show up on the stage? Mm. How does that go?
It all depends. A good costume designer is always in dialogue with the lighting designer.
True.
And yeah, and if they're not, be wary.
And I think in an ideal situation, at least in my experience, the costumer invites the lighting designer to come to the costume shop, certainly to look at
mm-hmm.
clothing that's been pulled or things that are that exist that we know are going to go on stage, so that you have that first-hand experience
right.
with, you know, the silhouette and the color and the draping, all of that stuff.
The yeah. other thing that I do here is we actually have a sort of a makeshift light lab up there, is bring the costume down, throw it on the table, and put the gel in front of the light and see what it does. Because mm-hmm. sometimes it doesn't do what you're expecting it to. Mm-hmm. Or you find that there's a fabric that again has underlying bias to it that you can't see in fluorescent light that all of a sudden shows up under gel.
You mean a color bias or the fabric itself?
No, color bias. Ah. You know, it's like, this is very clearly, you know, but we use purple again. This is, you know, this is a purple, like say that blouse, you know, that has a cool bias to it, which...
So do I.
But, you know, but there might be something in the dye for that I can't see under this light, that all of a sudden if I put it under amber light, it would change.
Hmm, yeah.
Because, you know, fabrics are dyed with the same kind of... Sure. The pigments work the same way as paint.
Sure.
Yeah.
I think, too, a lot of confusion or surprises sometimes come from working in shops with fluorescent lighting. If you're dealing with fabric or dealing with paint in a shop that's fluorescent lighting, then you get it out on stage and, oh my God, that's not the color I painted. That's not the color of fabric that I chose, because it's just a night and day difference between that cool fluorescent light and the light that you get in here once you get into the theater. So,
you know, and there you get to the heart of something that is, again, very physics oriented, is that fluorescent light, well, any light but incandescent light and the sun, well, even the sun, is what we call spectral, in that it's a combination of different frequencies of light waves, whereas incandescent light comes from what we call a black body source, so that there's a certain amount of every frequency available or in that light, and so there's a a term out there that you might see, particularly at, like these days on LED lights, that the CRI is 80 or the CRI is 95. That's the color rendering index. And incandescent light has a color rendering index of 100. And most like fluorescent light, like you find in a shop, is more like 70. Mm-hmm. And like the ugly high pressure sodium lights that you used to see, that yellow light, street lights, you know, that color rendering index is more like 55. Because there are just some colors you just don't see under that light. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons we have not switched out our work lights here to an LED is we keep waiting for there to be a near 100% CRI on a powerful work light. Mm-hmm. Philips Osram has developed one. The thing is, they're $300 a piece, and right now
we're not doing that.
Right now we haven't made that leap because our 300-watt quartzes, you know. Yeah, we have to change them a couple times a year, but you know, they're $6.
I'd be interested in speaking of LED lighting, kind of what, from your perspective as a lighting scenic designer, the impact of LED lighting to incandescent lighting in terms of the quality of
the light. It's a constantly evolving technology, and it's way, way, way better than it was 5 years ago. 5 years ago, I wouldn't touch it for anything other than like drops or backlight. And I have been working in more and more places that have some LED lights. I've yet to light in a space that's all LED. It'll happen. But there isn't, in most existing theater spaces, you're going to start to see more and more hybrid rigs. Because there are some things LEDs do that are just fantastic, like the blues. Because ironically, incandescent light is the best in the yellow-red range. Red is actually the hardest color to produce with an LED light. And most LED fixtures, just the reds don't punch like you'd expect them to. But my God, the blues and the indigos are just electric.
Our new sign, mm-hmm. you know, Theater in the Round sign with that big circle on it, that is now LED after being neon since 1985.
Right.
And I don't know if any of you've seen it at night. It glows.
Kind of obnoxious, actually.
It's I mean, like you know, you see the light of it on the cars across the street.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's so vivid and bright. You know.
What is finally happening with the high-end LED fixtures is that the pale tones and the pale palettes are starting to get good enough, as is the dimming capacity, that you can actually do smooth fades to black without any flicker or problems at the low end. That was the biggest issue to deal with LED, well, the second biggest. But then was also getting, you know, the subtleties between, say, a bastard amber and a pale gold and a peach pink, or, you know, a light pink that actually looked as good as incandescent lighting on the skin, took a lot of development.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, still, I sometimes go into a space and say, if they've put in LED lights and they're so proud of them, I'm like, yeah, you put up $100 DJ lights and the blues are great, but I can't make the skin look good with these. Whereas if I order a light from, you know, Color Kinetics or ETC or Philips that I pay $1,000 or $1,200 for, well, it dang well better render well, and it does. Because those were designed for theatrical applications and to produce those subtleties. And it's great fun to sit down at the light board and wash a set in one color, and then with three button strokes and the same lights, take it from pink to amber to green to blue. Because mm-hmm. the new LED lights, most of the ones we're using in theater it's infinitely variable color-wise. Now, there are certain lights that are being made primarily for film and other studio use that are single color, that are specifically balanced to a particular color temperature that the film or the camera likes.
So when you're mixing colors on people on stage, like in this show, you know, we pretty much all the time want people to look pretty nice, mm-hmm. to look good, you know. So that's not always true, you know. And I mean, in suddenly last summer, you know, everybody was well lit, but it wasn't a nice show. I mean, you know,
right.
it had, you know, very the whole subject of the show was quite unpleasant and sinister. And so what do you do different?
In that play, I didn't actually set out to make it look sinister, because not at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
By the end, I did.
You mean from the beginning of the show to the end of the show?
Right. Because okay. by the end of the show, when Catherine was, you know, basically running around the stage here, recounting the death of, you know, her cousin, by then I drained most of the color out of it. And she was running around in what I call a neutral color, which is like a violet and sort of a... what should I say? It's violet and purple are two very different colors, which is a mistake sometimes people make. But I just wanted it to look, for the color to be largely gone, and for her to look and feel very isolated on the stage. And that was what the director wanted, because he had... all the other characters had sort of gone out to the edges of the arena, and I had two various systems of tighter pools of light. And when she was running around telling that story, and then she sort of darted in and out of the light, and mm-hmm. the angles were quite steep on it. And the whole point of that was that as she was, you know, in the light here and then crossing out of it, that the light represented her sanity. Mm-hmm. And that she was popping in and out of her sanity with the light. And that by the end of that, she was isolated center stage in this very tight pool of straight down light, where you really lost her facial features, and you were just seeing her in this unflattering, cold light of an angle that reduced her facial features to just shadows. And that was us very intentionally manipulating the audience.
So you're draining the color from the stage.
Mm-hmm.
So all the color that there was at the beginning.
All that exoticness from the garden and those lush gobo washes that gave all
green
that texture
foliage
and the
around
green foliage.
And everything.
It was all in the dark by then.
Yeah.
That was one of those situations where the effect, I thought it was more severe than it needed to be, but the director kept saying more, more. And I'm like,
okay. Yeah. Yeah. So now what questions do you have about where you have got experience doing things? Yes?
I'm curious. So you mentioned the color wheel, the red, blue, green, and then the colors in between those, but where is amber at?
What you want to find, see if I can find that color wheel. You want a color wheel that looks more like this. You know, where all the secondary and tertiary colors are in it. Because here you can see, you know, you've read now, and this is more representational, though, of the kind of thing I look at when I start pairing colors. Because amber falls between green and red as a tertiary color. So
it's sort of amazing that people look good under that. But we do.
You do, and... you know, there's even more complicated things in here that you also have to take into consideration, is this concept of color temperature. I don't know if any of you know what that means, or is that a familiar phrase to anyone? It comes out of physics, And it's more of an issue in, I don't really pay attention to color temperature that much when I'm thinking about stage lighting, but you have to think about it when you're talking about film lighting or TV lighting, because how to start with this complicated thing? You know, this subject that I could teach a semester class on. Right. Basically, all light can be has a color temperature, and that's based on a physics theory that a piece of metal actually reaches this temperature of degrees Kelvin, which is 0 degrees Kelvin is absolute zero, which is, what is it? Is that 200 and something below Celsius? I forget.
Any physicists in the house?
That sounds right.
One. Excellent.
Right. And so, but the big numbers when you're talking about theater lighting, about color temperature, is it starts getting interesting at about 2,800 degrees Kelvin is sort of the temperature, color temperature of, say, a 100-watt light bulb. And that's often the color temperature you're going for if you're producing an LED light bulb or the what we would call the warm white fluorescents that have that sort of pinker glow to it. Stage and studio lighting, the industry standard for television cameras and some film, even though that's kind of an obsolete thing, I guess, but I trained on real film, is 3,200 degrees Kelvin. If you go into an old-fashioned TV studio, all the light was at 3,200 degrees Kelvin because that produced the best effect, and that's what the cameras were white balanced for. The fluorescent lights, up in the booth, those run about 4,100 degrees Kelvin. Daylight in the sun at the Eastman Kodak factory,
which is the only place it counts,
was determined to be 5,500 degrees Kelvin for color balancing on color film back in the day. Wow. And then when you get to a really cloudy, kind of bluish day, that can go upwards of 12,000 degrees Kelvin.
So now, when you buy a light bulb at the store, mm-hmm. used to be they didn't have that little scale on it, so, on the little box that said warm to cool or something
right.
like that, and they would tell you where this bulb is in this. What's that? I had a direct experience with this. I have a purple bathroom.
Yeah.
So I've been using those lights that are kind of blue colored, mm-hmm. and then, I looked alive. When I looked at myself in the mirror, I did not look, pale and green or anything. And the walls looked great. That bulb died, so I put in one of those new ones, some LED light or something like that. And suddenly, I looked about 75 years older and pasty-faced, and the purple in my bathroom was just sort of icky. And mm-hmm. so I thought, and then I get my little boxes out, and it's like one is way over there, and then one is way over there, and that's what you're talking about
exactly. That's what LEDs. With incandescent light, you were strapped in that basically they looked good and produced decent amounts of light between about 2,000 degrees Kelvin, and 3,200 was starting to push it for what you could get out of an incandescent filament balancing life and brightness. Back in the day, they made these the photo flood lights, which produced much, much more blue light. But they lasted 4 hours. And that was the point, is that it was a way to get that much light out of an incandescent, but you always the bluer the incandescent light gets, the shorter the life it's going to have, and the less light it's going to put out. Because it's just, the technology is just not, it just doesn't do that. Whereas LED, it's anyone's game. You can make them as blue as you want.
Rick, can you tell about, in this theater, you've done a ton of shows here, one mm-hmm. way or another. What was one that you liked the best, or was one of the 10 or 20 that you liked the best, and it was because of how the colors went? or how everything, you know, like was one unit of that you can conjure up. This is unrehearsed. Did you
totally
notice
unrehearsed.
It? Yeah. No cue cards here.
One of my favorite shows, one of the first shows that I did here, which was back in the 70s with a director by the name of Larry Whiteley.
Oh, my God.
Who has since passed away, but he did a lot of shows here.
Yeah.
Feet in the Round.
I remember him because he was in the Nixon administration.
Right. The whole arena was, we literally pasted on the floor newspapers, and every bit of furniture and everything in the arena was covered with newsprint.
Jeez.
With print, I mean actual news paper. So it was this amazing kind of black and white palette, and totally up to the lighting designer to manipulate color on the set. And just in my design experience, it's been fun to do black and white sets in tandem with a lighting designer to have this kind of blank palette in a way, and create the color totally with the lighting. So that image just strikes me because just the arena, the modesty panels, all the pieces that we brought in here were basically white, and the color came from the lighting design.
We did that fairly recently again.
Yes.
With Fahrenheit 451,
right, yes.
Where basically the whole set was decoupaged in yellow pages from old books.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And but we had a lot more technological tools to throw at that now,
right.
Because we were also doing, we did projection, we did TV projection on the set, mm-hmm. and then, you know, just crazy color palettes that I really saturated colors that you could mix and then just kind of keep playing around with that. That was probably one of the more exciting and interesting shows I've lit here recently. Well, Jekyll and Hyde was a great fun too. That was a totally different color palette because it was very dark and sinister, and I made an interesting choice for that is that my warm area lights, I actually used a gaslight green because I wanted that, I wanted the bright scenes to have, for people to have that kind of sickly pallor to them. That was quite intentional. So yeah, those are some of the things you can do with color.
And I think that's sort of what we're always doing. We talk before we kind of started about the idea of manipulating the audience, and certainly color is one of the ways that all of us as designers, scenic designer, costume, lightings, that's what we're doing. We are really impacting the audience perception of a particular character, a particular scene, or the dynamic of a particular moment in the play, simply because of how we perceive color, what we associate color with. I did, when I was teaching, would do an exercise with any of my design classes, whether it was scenic design or lighting or costuming, and we had a whole chart of how we perceive color, and the color red can be fire or the devil, but it's also Valentine's and love. So you might, you know, we think of color as sort of associated with one particular thing, but if you really break that down, that association can kind of go both ways. So, as we play with color as designers, it is a matter of what the audience perception is going to be of that color, how that impacts that particular scene.
Like, is green nature or is it envy?
Yeah,
again,
exactly.
You know,
exactly. Right.
And is blue nighttime and sinister or is it water?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, water is life-giving and dangerous. So, you know, there's that.
There's nothing safe out there.
You know, water can be quite toxic in the wrong situation.
It's all about the amount.
Right.
The,
yeah.
Well, what are, when you go and see other productions, what are some of your pet peeves when you know about the lighting and the colors that you notice and you think, oh, if only they took this into consideration or something like that. Does that ever, as just as you know, doing this professionally, do you notice things?
Oh God! Yes.
You're poisoned by your knowledge. You know.
True. Well, I've been talking a lot. Do you have some things?
Tell about how you're poisoned.
I have a particular obsession with props because props is kind of one of the things that I love to do, and so I'm always looking for sort of things that are out of place in terms of period or color.
Mm-hmm. The humidor.
Those things just kind of jump out at me simply because it's something that I've done for a long time. I've researched for a long time. Mm-hmm. I have a sense of period and style, so that's the kind of thing that jumps
out. Do you even notice that in like TV productions and films?
Oh, yeah, yeah, I'm always looking for that.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I mean, I often am looking more for, like, new ideas and techniques to steal.
True.
You know, because one thing I have not done a lot of that sort of intrigues me is there are some lighting designers out there that use little or no color. It's all about angle, and those designs always kind of intrigue me because I'm like, how did you establish that mood without color? Mm-hmm. But it worked. One of my pet peeves is lighting designs that are too bright. I'm trying to... What is... this was at the G 5-8 years ago. In Chicago, the play where the white family moves out in the 50s and the black family moves in, and then it flips around in the second act.
Oh, Clyburn Park.
Clyburn Park.
Yep.
I hated the lighting for that show because I was squinting because it was so damn bright. And I'm just like, look, it's a fairly straightforward box set, and I know you have 500 lights in this theater. Did you need to use all of them?
In the first half, the second half, or both? Because I remember the first half being really bright.
The first half.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The second half was a little more shadowy.
Right. Maybe that was their attempt to manipulate that the first half was bright and the second half was more shadowy. But I was just like, this hurts. Because I was like in the third world.
Yeah.
We were discussing another, which was the production of The Jungle. Audience blinders, very sparing.
The Nether.
The Nether. If you're going to shine lights on the audience...
He means directly in your
In your face.
Not shining where you're sitting.
Like flashlight from the stage. Mm-hmm. To
right. Yeah. You know, boy, more than 5 seconds and I'm just irritated.
Yeah. I'm always fascinated just as a designer in general looking at lighting, the idea of bright lights. I find it much more interesting. I love a lighting designer who will use patterns on the stage, so that actors kind of walk in and out of modeled lighting. And it's very frustrating for me, because I designed lights for a number of years at the college, that a director would keep saying, I can't see their faces. So you keep bumping up light here and bumping up light there, until you've kind of got this bland wash, where it's much more interesting, I think, to have those shadows. And especially in a theater like this, it fascinates me to see actors walking in and out of that light, and there is that kind of modeling. There's a much more interesting texture for lighting. So I'm very aware of that kind of thing when I watch a show. I'm very aware of the lighting, too.
I mean, that's been one of the biggest changes in the industry since I started doing lighting in high school, is we just didn't have the instruments or the dimmers to do a lot of gobo washes.
Sure.
Gobos were kind of something you reserved for an offstage window look or something like that. Mm-hmm. And nowadays, I find in most of my designs, probably 20% of my lights are dedicated towards texture pattern washes. Just to do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or things like the Moby Dick that I've got up right now over at Fallout Co-op. I put up a full stage gobo wash with rotators, and whenever they're at sea, those are on, and you just sort of see the light, that dancing light, like reflections off the water. I did the same thing for Private Lives from here when they were on the patios in the first scene, mm-hmm. that there was like this rippling effect of the setting sun off the waves, mm-hmm. so that there was just this slight sense of movement of the light constantly, mm-hmm. and you know, the difference is that if you notice it, it's probably too much.
True.
But you know, but also like whenever you're in an exterior scene of shooting through foliage or things like that, or so that it looks like you're in the backyard and you're under a tree and the light is modeled.
Are there any gobos in this show?
Maybe. I don't know. I haven't looked.
I saw it last night.
Mark usually uses some.
I don't remember.
You know, it's a little tricky.
If you notice it, it might be too much.
It's a little trickier when you're in an interior set, because it's not that you don't use them. You just have to be a little more careful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no trees overhead.
Because there's
your house. Yeah.
It becomes an unmotivated wash at that point. And which is fine.
Just showing off, you know.
Yeah.
That you've got that gobo set.
I mean, I'm trying to think, like, one thing I did do in Jekyll and Hyde is and a lot of times some of these things, you hang these lights and you drop these gobos in and you're like, oh, I kind of like that. I should do that more. And sometimes you put it up and you're like, oh, no, not going to use those. But in that show, whenever we were in the transformation, I washed the stage from one angle with this red flame gobo. And was it heavy-handed? Maybe. I liked it.
Did anyone say, absolutely not?
No, of
no.
course not.
So, well, there you are then.
And George was like, oh, I like that.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I think all designers, we have to be careful about things that draw too much attention to themselves. And I think that's especially true of color in any of our disciplines. If something's going to be like, if that's the thing that the audience walks away talking about, then we probably have missed the mark there. So it's a balancing act. You know,
that Jeffrey Undergarland, right?
Right. I mean, there's one thing to have color as an accent when it helps reinforce a character or a scene or move the play along. But I think, again, generally we have to be aware of drawing too much attention to any of those elements that we as designers put in there. And color is one of the strongest influencers, the strongest things that audience relate to. So kind of tempering that to make it work within the overall picture is a consideration for all of us
as designers. Painting the floor banana yellow is not a good idea unless you've got a really good reason.
Right. Yeah.
I like one of the my least favorite set designs I've ever had to light here was that orange floor in Richard III. It was supposed to be this sort of muted salmon, and it just came out orange, and it was just ugly, and it was.
I helped paint that, by the way.
No, I'm sorry. did you like it?
Well, I was earlier in my very brief watercolor career, so you know, I thought it was kind of cool to paint it, you know, but I didn't have any thoughts about whether or not that would work well for the show. I mean, we painted, you know, blood up the modesty panels, yeah. You know, I mean,
right.
There was a sort of red everywhere.
What happened is because the floor was so orange, the blood didn't really
look red
pop.
Enough. It wasn't, yeah, there was too much of color,
mm-hmm.
so therefore sort of not enough blood then,
right.
Or something.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know, we've been talking a lot.
I really appreciated like the demo you'd done earlier, and I know that we've got a strong scenic and lighting component here, but I'm wondering if there's ways to bring the costuming in, like, is there a way to like even just use people in the audience or like you commented on her pinkish, you know, shirt? Is there a way to like bring up some lights on, you know, even just what you had brought up, like how that green chair turned blue? You know, can we like use some people's clothing and pull up some lights on?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you have red, and then you have a bunch of different colors, and then you have grays and blacks, and you have sort of, I think that's brown, or I mean, you know, and then there's a bright light gray up there, and you know, among us, I think, you know, and you know, I think among us we have enough colors to.
Because I'm curious now. I want to see if some other bias comes out of your picture.
See what the bias is in my. Yeah. Yeah.
Or see if the brown on her turns muddy purple.
Well, as a watercolorist, I know how to get mud, let me just tell you. I'm pretty skilled at mud.
Well, again, when I teach a beginning lighting class, one of the kind of labs that we do, I go down and raid costume storage and pull out, you know, a red dress and a yellow dress and a green dress and hang them up and have students, it's the day that we start playing with color media.
It'd be great if we could do that here.
Figure out a color that makes this looks beautiful and figure out one that makes it look ugly. So they have two light fixtures and they play with it so that to see that contrast, to actually see physically what a color, especially in lighting, does.
Yeah, now you're going toward violet under that.
Yeah, my skin looks kind of yellowy. But please come down and
well, I'm gonna get my dark blue off here because I got a nasty red shirt underneath.
Home improvement.
So that's why I'm dressed nasty.
Yeah, please come.
But yeah, colors. Yeah, yours too. You got a pattern on yours.
Yeah, you got a pattern.
And we have these costuming folks in the audience. I thought we should do something for them.
Yeah, we got some light here now.
Some light.
So I mean, this is Q5. I don't know what.
Right, we've got to run back and forth to see what it looks like.
So, but you know, here, if I look at what he has done, you know, so we've got that amber wah, double warming here. That's interesting.
There's a real dark blue purple over there.
Yeah, that's a corner.
Other lights out?
This one, the
something? We want the help.
Oh, they don't do much at this point. So basically, there's. Let me see what I can isolate here.
Magic of electricity. I mean, I think it's amazing that you can push buttons from down here and cue the lights up there. It's like.
I'm still amazed.
The amount of things I don't know about.
No, I'm amazed.
Like, I was amazed you could you could take a piece of rock and scrape it on a piece of plastic and get a symphony. And now all I can do is shine a blinking light on it and you get a symphony. So, it's all a mystery to me.
Yeah. Okay, so this is very cool now. Okay, so now, does anybody look good in this blue?
Her blue's just popped in that last blue. That's a nice one. The blue you pulled up before. Oh, look how warm her brown looks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So over here is this bastard amber. And then that's blue.
Here is more cool.
So you know, here are some different things on different parts of the stage.
So we have the same color here.
Right, but look at the wax though.
Yeah.
A little bit.
And then
mostly amber.
Yeah, and that's a nice warm brown this one.
Right. And then, you know, say when I'm here, you know, the blue in the shirt now really pops under this pale blue light. But if I come over here, you know, now, well, it's still blue, but you really see the amber tint of the underlying white. And, you know, the olive pants look very different in that light than they do in this light.
So do your beige.
Yeah.
Is that white? Are you in white or beige?
This is a beige, yeah.
Okay.
See, but on that light, it looks pretty much white. If you come over into the amber, it's going to look probably, you know, it's definitely, we're going to know that that's beige.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then with your sweater on, with the patterns on it, if you stand over there in that blue light, then the colors sort of look like they're fading all together. And if you're over here then, since we have the stage up there. That makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
What's the red do? The red would be a dramatic difference, I think.
It's two different reds.
I don't see any red in this
plot. No, but I mean on Roberta's
Sure. Probably very different from over there to over here. And it
looks really cool. I've never, I don't know. Yeah. I think of red as a cool color.
Oh, yeah.
Wow, that's a big difference.
Yeah.
They're like completely now, different
almost
colors.
Orangey. Yeah.
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 Almost,
yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
And then the gray is the gray will be duller in the blue light or not?
I like the way her colors pop. Could you do that blue to amber thing?
The bowling center.
Yeah.
You've got like the whole rainbow, so.
Wow.
So the blues really pop out on it, and everything else
comes
off. Yeah.
But she gets a fluorescent in that purpley.
Yeah.
That pink is almost fluorescent a little bit.
Yeah. And then you with the black t-shirt there.
Into the amber.
Color on your.
Can you go into the amber?
Just like cream.
Yeah.
She's got blue
behind
her
now.
Yeah. So the amber like this orange is.
Yeah. Now the orange is a pink side.
That's a cool shirt for this.
You should wear that all the time.
Yeah.
You go to lighting.
Example.
You go to color. When you go to color things, you should wear that. All the colors you can get.
Yeah.
So then black stays black then, or it depends on the black. So
it depends on the black, because it all depends on what made the black in terms of the dye. Because some blacks turn brown under certain lights, some blacks take on a bluish cast. It's always kind of interesting if you have two pieces of black fabric, and they look absolutely black under one light source, and you put them in another light source, and you're like, whoa, those are two very different blacks. That becomes a problem when you're trying to mask things in the theater.
Oh, yeah.
And all of a sudden, one black turns brown, and the other one turns blue.
Yeah.
So here you can see a little bit. In this light, you notice that this is, it's green. But you put it in this light, and it's, see what it changes? Yeah. Because this.
Dull. It's duller.
Right. And you see how, this looks very sort of interesting in that light, but here this just pops.
Mm-hmm. And those two are exactly the same color, aren't they?
They're the same color here. But this one, this one is largely right now in a. Right, you see how the between here. There it's very much it's maroon and tan. And you see, you put this in this light, and this just really grays down.
Green and red.
Yeah, you really see the green in a way that over in this light, the maroon dominates.
Hmm. Hmm.
Where did it start with you?
Yeah.
Be careful for
Well, at least
the chessboard is set up in standard beginning configuration.
Yeah.
Stop! Yeah. Put your hands in your pockets. It's a crime.
I know.
But I think, too, in the same way that I was saying before, that to allow a lighting designer to take a paint chart or a costume and play with lighting. The reverse is true too. I mean, the scenic designer and the costume designer can certainly have that conversation with the lighting designer, and if there's a particular palette that the lighting designer feels is best for the show, then we make accommodations as costumers or as scenic designers too. I'll pick a different paint color that has a different bias that will be more flattering with the lighting, or if I have a choice of two fabrics and kind of determine the color palette for the lighting, then I'll go with that fabric that's more complementary. So it really is a lot of give and take. We jokingly always say, well, we'll pick that with lighting. That's easy to say, but
and sometimes we do.
And sometimes we do. But the costumer and the scenic designer can certainly play into that equation and make those adjustments so that whole stage picture is more flattered by us making those adjustments to it, and not hoping the lighting designer will fix this somehow.
As I look around at faces here, so if you have blue on one whole side of your face, and your face is mostly blue, and then you have the warm colors on this side, so if you turn your head the other way, you know, then your hair is blue, and the rest of, yeah. And then you're still very blue. Your face is quite.
Well, and you see what's going on there is we have warm light on her face, but we have that sort of turquoisey light, which is not supposed to be a backlight, but it is acting that way right now. And that's one way to get contrast and to set things apart. Because the top light slash backlight can be very important for creating definition. So that you don't just fade into the background. I think that's one of my bigger pet peeves is lighting designs that don't use backlight, and it becomes very one-dimensional, or very two-dimensional. It's not three-dimensional. Mm-hmm. I'm only seeing width and height. I'm not seeing depth. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
See, and as a budding watercolorist, I've learned about negative painting.
Mm-hmm.
So you paint around something. I mean, this is all news to me. You paint around something, and that's how that something gets to be there. Because, you know, it shows up, and it didn't, you know, but you're not painting it. You're painting everything that's not
there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sometimes I go see shows at Palmer's, and it's just like a bar stage, but they have some sort of, like, intense, I think it's red and blue, but when I look at the people, like, you can't see their faces. It's like they're double their blur or something.
Mm-hmm.
What would make it do that?
Bad lighting.
No front light?
Too many drinks?
I don't know. It might be lack of front light that it's top light or side light.
Okay, so I think it's like that colors.
Where did you say you're seeing it? In Palmer's?
On the West Bay?
Palmer's. Oh, I see.
It's like there's
for, like,
the genital stage.
Yeah, for the fans and stuff.
You know, one other thing just about color palettes in general is he was saying, you know, when I start a lighting design, taking into consideration what is going on with costumes and set, you know, is I always sort of, the first thing I do is I decide what's my primary area warm going to be and what's my primary area cool going to be. And there are some colors that actually are chameleon-like in that too, where, you know, amber is always warm. Pink is almost always warm, but like a violet can go either way. Because I have used violets as my warm against a really cold blue, but I've also used violets as my cool against an amber. And because that's, it wouldn't really be color bias, but once you set that palette up, another thing that's a lot of fun to do sometimes is you play with the physics of the eye. Like, if you put someone in really blue light for maybe 5 minutes, all the blue receptor, the cones, you know, the blue cones.
I'm in a color theory class, right?
The blue cones have been depleted more so because they've been doing their thing. And if you bring up warm light right after that blue, it appears a lot warmer than it really is because of the neurochemistry of your eye.
Mm-hmm. So you're having to take into consideration, like, with just the amount of time even, that you had a color up, so as far as the audience, get, you know.
Well, right, because this has happened to me a couple times where I've gone into blood red light for the murder or something like that, and that's been up for like 3 minutes, and then you bring the other lights up and the director will say, well, that isn't the same light you had up before, and I'm like, yes, it is. You just don't have any red. Your red receptors are just depleted right now compared to your other ones.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So do they sometimes request that you alter the one that comes up after such as 3 minutes?
Sure. And I might say yes, and I might say no.
Sure, too much to do.
As I said, I see Rick has entirely blue hair.
Yeah.
And the edges of your glasses are blue.
Is it a good look for me?
Yeah, well, it's a negative painting wise. Yeah, I mean, you have a halo.
Makes
you
look really tan.
So it looks very tan
on your face.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing.
Question about when you were talking about sort of the team and how they you know, the designers, how they speak to one another in the process of creating the show. I imagine it depends on the director, what sort of their bias when they had their training, or were they more into lighting? Were they more into set design? As far as who they consult first, as far as, like, maybe they get a concept, but then they want to go to one of the designers first. Like, they tend to gravitate and say, oh, so this director tends to be a lighting-biased director, or this director tends to be more into the costumes, or just, you know, whatever. I mean, how cool is that, like, depending?
To some extent.
Does it all kind of balance out in the end?
Often. Not always. You know, I can just think of certain directors. They seem to gravitate towards the set first, just because it's the largest element, and it's the one that's going to take the most time, typically, to produce. It's just a lot of things need to be coordinated in building the set, depending on the theater and the resources.
But they could go with, sorry to interrupt, but they could go way simpler on the set if they can consider the lighting first, even potentially.
Sometimes, oh sure, and you know, and there will be times like, you know, like this set for Theater in the Realm. This is a fairly typical interior, you know, Agatha Christie box set, such as we can do them here. So you know, there's a lot of build in this, or no, I shouldn't say a lot, but a fair amount. Actually, this was a lot of collecting furniture.
Yeah, because you know, the only thing that's different here is the modesty panels have all been redone. We have several sets of modesty panels, so we keep one that's plain black and happy, and then we have one that we just put whatever the other one on and take it off and then do it again.
That's what this is.
Yeah, these modesty panels, you know. But usually, generally for sets I've seen here over the many decades, there have been more levels on the stage than, you know, than this show has.
Yeah, and you know, like the designs I just saw for Rhinoceros this morning that Dieter's been working on, that's a show that's going to be on a unit set, meaning you have to be in, there are four different locations that happen in the four scenes, if you will, of that play. The first scene is all takes place outdoors on a Sunday afternoon. The second scene all takes place in a legal publishing firm. And then the last two scenes take place theoretically in bedrooms, two different bedrooms, although you have Rhinoceros is running through those bedrooms, which is part of the play. Because a rhinoceros running through the town square on a sunny afternoon is absurd but plausible. Whereas a rhinoceros running through someone's bedroom in the middle of the night is just absurd. And so Dieter's got, it's going to be, this part of the stage is going to be built up to this level, over in this neck of the woods, all the way over to here, so that we can have the stairs that get destroyed can crash down back there and there's some interesting lighting on them. And then there's an intermediary level sort of in here, and then this over here is all flat. But the whole stage then is going to be painted and textured in this sort of pebble, or you know, sort of a rock paver sort of a look, roughly based on a rhinoceros's hide.
Sure.
You know, so that's that kind of crazy creative stuff you can do. And when you're in a unit set like that, then the lighting, you establish more with the lighting than you do, say, in this set.
Yeah.
Because like when they're in the office and they look out the window, well, I know I'm going to be asked to put a window globe here, where you see the sun shining in through a window, so that they can step into that sunlight and look out like they're looking out a window.
And I very often had the scenic designer directors, me, especially with a set, the unit set basically that takes place in a lot of different towns. You know, we don't need to worry about that physically. We'll define that with light.
Right.
Depend on the lighting to isolate that particular space, and maybe you throw a window pattern in there to suggest another room. So it's nice to have work with a director who can visualize that and can say, lighting will be enough to define that scene. We don't need that couch, and we need a wall to come in, and a wagon.
Right.
We'll define that space with lighting. So. know, it, to work with directors who can be that visual from the start is really helpful. Mm-hmm.
Something that I do a lot in this space with unit sets is defining certain areas or rooms with a certain pattern. Mm-hmm. So like in when we did Richard III, whenever we were in the, you know, the Royal Chambers, I projected, the breakout projection was like this fancy lattice work grid. And whenever we were, you know, outside in the woods, it was foliage. And whenever we were on the street, it was something else, you know. And it's a sort of a subtle way of creating place with lighting.
Or actually the only scenery there was is what?
Right.
Yes.
I mean, because like with Richard III, I mean, George tends to do his Shakespeare sort of, you know, globe style. You know, bare stage,
yeah.
Minimal props, and you know the actors tell us where they are,
right.
Or we just know where they are,
yeah,
because that's just what we do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, it's because especially in this theater, we rarely do, you know, complicated multi sets.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, to be honest, private life is one of the more complicated. Transformation. It's like, so how do you get a grand piano in for the second act? Well, it's on the patio and it's covered with something with plants.
Yeah.
Over here.
Well, in this theater is, you know, as it being in the round and all, every designer who designs a set here knows that modesty panel and the modesty panel that is missing from over there, they need to come up and out, and in place of the modesty panel, we pull out the several chairs in each of those locations, and that is where wheelchair persons go. So, yes,
yep.
So you can't have, you know, you have to have accessible seating for people in this theater when you have to go across the floor of the stage to get to your chair.
Right.
So,
and which also means you can never build up. You have to leave an unobstructed path to these spots in your floor design, which is why we tend to build up over on that side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've been here long enough to remember, you know, the olden days when there was no planning for accessibility in this theater or any other ones, really, particularly.
Mm-hmm.
And there would be sets that would, you know, just be all over the place, and, you know, risers and things like that everywhere. So that's.
And because the audience over here has to walk through the whole set, that's something that they're always, whenever you get a new set designer in, it's like, you can build up, you just can't build up higher than 14 inches, and you have to get there via 7-inch increments. Because it has to feel like a set. Because if you do 3, you know, 4-inch rises, people catch their toes on them, because they're just weird.
Yeah.
We had a problem with that a while back with a set for a Drawer Boy. Also, you can't put anything in front of these modesty panels that's going to obstruct the view. You know, you can't park a refrigerator that's this high here. I'm actually a little bit surprised that this is here. Because I think that the soldiers are such an integral part of this set that they make sense here and you can see between them. I wouldn't know. I'm just in front of that the whole time.
Well, you'll have to take that up with someone else.
But and also things like lamps and that, you can't put a floor lamp this high in here.
Mm-hmm.
Because it means that anyone here, you know.
Well, and also we can't have things hanging down very far from the ceiling because this, you know, like this is 16 feet high here.
Right.
And so, you know, there's people who are sitting, you know, way up in those top rows and they have to be able see what's going on over here without looking through the fixtures.
Right.
There have often been quite a bit of carpentry up there, you know, big, you know, plant holding vines and all kinds of stuff up there. And you have to sort of pay attention to that. First of all, how do you light around them? and then how do you have it not be obscured from people in the top rows? So, yeah.
Yeah, what was the show?
probably 6 or 8 years ago, where they actually built a false ceiling in here. And it was a Hoover design.
Yes, it was a Hoover
design. It would be a Hoover design.
Big circular ceiling.
Right.
Conservatory or something.
Right.
Yeah.
And I mean, Andy still talks to Stable, what a pain in the butt it was to light.
Light around. Yeah. It's challenging.
Yeah, when you have a proscenium, you know, I mean, you can put it any old area you want.
You know, another thing that just occurs to me, that we make absolutely no pretense in this room about trying to mask lighting. It's just there. Which I see as, you know, I think there was a time, maybe up until sometime in the 80s, where that was considered a goal in a theater, is to have the light sources not be seen.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that as kind of a dead project.
Yeah.
Because I see lights everywhere I go now.
You do.
So what are your thoughts about things? Does this make you all want to come and be a volunteer?
Definitely for me.
The correct answer is yes.
Do you have tons of different workshops? We're going to come to that painting one in a couple of weeks. But I mean, are there just a bunch of workshops and then, okay, now you can come and be a volunteer or what?
Tony, would you care to address that?
You could be a volunteer if you show up.
Tony is.
You don't have to go to the workshops.
No. Nope. You just let us know that you want to volunteer, and we put on a list for emails for that area. Mm-hmm. So if you're not interested in costumes, you won't get the emails for costume people.
I see.
And so on. So I just find out what you're interested in, if you have any experience in it or not, and then when we need people to build the set or to paint the floor or whatever, I pull out the list of just those people that have marked an interest in doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And then usually you'll work with the designer or our technical director, who are very good at teaching you how to do what you're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And the longer you're here, the more you learn.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people who have started here not knowing much, and they're designers now. You know, they're a lighting designer that I'm thinking of, and things like that, just because they were here. They put so much time into it, and they personally wanted to get to that goal.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an avenue for doing that, was just spending enough time here with a number of different designers, learning from them,
mm-hmm.
and while just doing the actual job.
I mean, I came here as a volunteer, having not done lighting for about 15 years, because I was focused on something else in a career, and I was done with that career in my mind, and I was like, well, I'll go back to theater. And so I started showing up for light hangs, and I ran light board for a couple of shows, and you know, you work with some good designers, you sort of learn the hacks of the space and how to do this stuff, and you know, now 3-4 years later, I'm designing for Theater Coup d'Etat, who's one of the productions I've lived with them, one in Ivy. We're bringing a production over to the Park Square's secondary space in a year, and I'll get to design that now at one of the big houses, you know. And this place has been an avenue for a lot of talented theater folk who are now making a living off of it.
Great. I have regularly seen people on this stage and say that we're never going to see them again. They're going directly to Equity.
Yeah.
And you just see it. It's like these people are luminaries, you know. I mean, you're all here today not because you've never heard of Feet on the Round. You know, how many of you have seen a show here? Yeah, me too. So this is a very out of the ordinary place to be a volunteer. We have really good equipment, and the things you learn about a light board or a sound board here are things that you will find in other theaters.
Absolutely.
Yes.
I mean, that was one of the things, like 3 years ago when we put the new light board in. The old one was starting to fail. But, you know, it's like, yeah, it's time we got the board, the same board they're using at the big houses here, because we need that, you know, interchangeability.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like with the sound program. We were using SoundFX, which was a PC-based program, which is the program the Guthrie uses, but everyone else uses QLab. And so in that last change, we went to QLab. And
actually got a job because I've used QLab here. Just the basics here. and I ran a show for 5 months at Old Long. I was their cue lab operator for a run, just because of what I had seen and hear of cue lab. So it's a good starting place.
Are there age restrictions for volunteers?
I'm sorry, what?
Are there age restrictions?
To some extent, yeah.
Yeah, it's...
I think it's 16.
It is 16.
And I think for Stripe, does that bump to 18?
I think it does for Stripe.
Because the most dangerous time in any theater is Stripe. Because you have a lot of not necessarily theater professionals tearing a lot of things apart at the same time.
Yeah.
And trying to get to the bar.
Trying to have not fall on your head. Exhibit A.
Yeah, it's 9 times out of 10, if a serious accident happens in theater, it happens during Stripe.
This theater, I think, has always been a great training ground.
Absolutely.
When I was in graduate school, 1972, 73, Theater in the Round was a place that a lot of us came to from the theater department here on the West Bank. It was a great place to get some exposure, to get some experience, especially working in the Round was a different experience for most of us, but just a really welcoming, non-threatening, non-intimidating place to come and pick up some skills and work with designers who have been doing this for a while. So Theater and Around has a long history of welcoming volunteers and focusing on training volunteers and getting folks to have skills so that they will come back again and use those skills in other productions. So there's really a long history of.
And there's also certain like designers like Dieter. Have you worked with Dieter?
Mm-hmm.
You know, various places. And his main job now is he's the master electrician at the Fitzgerald, but he doesn't get to design much there.
Right.
So he still comes back here and does a show maybe once a year because he's a wickedly talented designer.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not where he makes his money. But he does that here from time to time just because it's an opportunity.
Yeah.
Well, and when Dieter first showed up in Minnesota from the wilds of
South Dakota
with his brand shiny new degree in theater, because of his experience in this small community in South Dakota, he had already done absolutely everything that gets done in a theater.
Right.
You know, because you know you don't get to decide, I'll just do lighting. No, you have to do lighting and just set and paint.
And probably play a secondary character.
Yeah, that too, you know, and besides he can act, you know. So he started out here and, you know, we're working for our, you know, designer Mike Hoover, who is at the Guthrie, and then next thing you know, Dieter's over at the Guthrie and he's painting in the scene shop and doing various electrician stuff, and then, well, now he's at the Fitzgerald. Okay, so...
Still doing overhire at the Guthrie.
Yes.
Because he is still one of the best people I know around town with the hot knife.
The carving up of things.
Carving up of foam.
Yeah, I mean,
he's
who knew,
really good at
who
that.
Who knew that there'd be a need for it? You know? I wouldn't have thought of it as a career.
It's a specific thing.
Yeah.
No,
so
if you see intricate carvings at the Guthrie, he was probably on the team.
Oh, it's a series.
Good heavens. Yeah, it's a real thing. Huh. Well, I learned even how to paint things black or white or sometimes brown and once green. For feeding around, so you know, as a essentially unskilled theater graduate, you know, with no experience on stage because I hate it out there because I can't remember anything anyway, and then you know, there's someplace for me to be too besides just being on the board. So I mean, it's really fun, you know, it's been fun really so far, you know, since like I said.
So you do obviously other. Work around town in the theater, do you as well,
mm-hmm.
as far as design?
Yeah, I was. I just retired from Normandale College. I was teaching the tech theater classes there, but I've always sort of maintained a freelance role doing props and scenery. I've got a show opening plug. History Theater next week that I did the scenery for. I'm working doing props for Annie at the Ordway. So I kind of
mm-hmm.
float around to a lot of different theaters in the community.
Like my primary part-time job is I am the coordinator of sound, lighting, and video at Central Lutheran Church. So that's like my, that's my core 15 to 25 hours a week. And then everything else is freelance stuff. You know, I pick up electrician calls at out in Bloomington, at Old Log, sometimes the Guthrie, sometimes Children's. You know, I'm not making much money on my design work, but that's not the point of it. I do this because I love it. And most lighting designers don't make much money at it. They make their money being electricians for the big houses. Because that's the union work that pays $22 an hour.
I think that's, in a way, sort of one of the perks of volunteering here is a lot of the designers who come through here do a lot of work outside of the theater. So it's kind of a way of making connections with some of those folks and with other theaters as well. So it's a good kind of networking situation too. I think that's something that's really a focus for you in terms of doing more theaters, just I think exposure to the folks that rotate through here who are involved with a lot of other theaters in the community. So it's kind of a perk there.
So on our website, there's a section at the top, there's tabs, and you click on opportunities, and then you choose design and tech and design. And there's the shows are all listed there, and then what areas each show is still needs people. So whether it's for the run of the show, so actually while it's going on with an audience, you can run the light board or the sound board. You don't need experience for that. You know, during tech week, the week before a show opens is tech week. You learn from the designer what needs to be done for that show to actually run the board. You're not going to program it and all that stuff, so it's not intimidating. But you can ask a lot of questions if you're interested in learning about it. You know, but that's one of the main starting points for people who have the time to commit for a four-week run.
Is it usually in the evenings and weekends?
Yes.
All of our shows run Fridays and Saturdays at 7:30 and Sundays at 2. So,
but as far as even, sorry to interrupt, but the like painting and
That's all over the map. It gets negotiated for each show depending on the designer and their hours. And, you know, like for the light hang for this show, because the designer has a full-time day job in tech, that all happened in the evenings. Now, like when I do a show, I tend to prefer to do that during the days and then leave the arena open at night if they want to do paint work then. We always have to dance. It's always hanging the lights and getting this floor painted are the two friction points that you have to work through on the front end.
And anything that you do with our tech director, Eric, he has just recently switched to where he has, he works 5 days a week, he's full-time, but he has, I think it's 2 days that he comes in really early and leaves by like 4 or something, but then the other 3 days, he works until 10:30 at night.
And he would come in till late afternoon.
Yeah, so that just started a few weeks ago.
Which is great for us, it's also great for his child and his wife.
Yes, they just had their first baby, and that's why he changed the schedule this way. But it works for people who don't have traditional 9-to-5 jobs, who want to come in during the day, but also everybody else who does have a 9-to-5 job, there's hours that they can still come in at night and do some of this stuff that they normally wouldn't. A chance to do because they have to be at work.
When you sign up for the email, you get the, you know, call for this week, blah, 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 and you get the dates and the times and instructions to respond for if you can come and work that day. And so, but it's all your choice, right? If you want to respond and say, I can work this day or this day. Yeah.
Well, and even for people who have such a low skill as I do, I mean, you know, generally speaking, everything that you can see here is three-dimensional. It's, you know, like the Modesty panels, something like that. Somebody has to paint them the first time because they start out as raw wood. So I can paint them the first time, you know, and you don't need a lot of supervision for that. I mean, I'm alone in the shop, not uncommonly painting things like that because there's no instruction needed. Make it quick, green, blonde, you know.
Right.
So.
Right.
So, you know, and then, you know, there's all kinds of way more skilled things to do, way more. But then I'm not looking for a career in theater at all.
Right.
Never did.
Like when we did Fahrenheit, I think we had upwards of 5 or 8 people in here doing that page
decoupage.
Because I don't know how many thousands of pages of books we glued to this set. It was a lot. And it was like full walls to the ceiling where the firehouse was, and it was all the set pieces were built for that, out of that, and covered. And it's a miracle we got it done. But
So if you go to that part of the website, you'll find my email there. My name's Tony. It's tony@theaterandround.org. And we'll set up a time to talk, and I'll find out what your interests are, if you have a background or not, and then just get you added to the email list for the right areas, and then it just goes from there. One show, like this show, like you said, they pulled most of the furniture for this show. The next show is going to be a lot of building.
Right.
You know, because there's going to be a lot of levels.
These layers of platforms.
Plus, something is always going on back there in the tunnel, where the only place that we can build up. Mm-hmm. So there's always something back there to build. So one show has a lot of building. Another show might have a lot more painting or something like that. So it just depends on what show is coming up, what the designer's needs are for volunteers.
And how good you are at painting rhinoceri skins on the floor.
Right.
Very many talents. So does anyone have any other questions or comments or thoughts? Or you're also, Tony knows who you are now. Sign up with her. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you guys. Thank you so much.
Thank
you.
Thank you.
Theater is
going to be
fun.
It's not always clean.
Most of the time. Most of the time.